This Week in Radio Tech, episode 293, is brought to you by the full range of Axia X nodes, one-touch simple setup balanced with powerful AOIP connection options. By Omnia Audio and the incredible Omnia 9 FM Plus HD audio processor featuring undo and declipping technology. And by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. LED light bulbs are finally getting useful and popular for home and business lighting. But LED lighting has been available for broadcast and cellular towers for over 15 years. Early models didn't last long. Rodney Ziegler with Nebraska Rural Radio Association joins us with his LED lighting experience spanning a decade with good news on this efficient technology. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm delighted to be here. I'm in a different spot today. Look at this room I'm in. I'm away from the usual office. Hey, this is This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about radio technology. Usually we're talking about audio and RF, but today it's quite a bit different. It still has to do with broadcast, very much so. And something that almost every broadcaster deals with. We'll tell you about the subject in just a minute. We've got a great guest. From a part of the world that most of us usually fly over, and he lives there and lives broadcasting and radio every single day. So hang on for that. We're going to announce that shortly. But first, let's check in with the best-dressed engineer in radio from the New York City area. It's Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris. Welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. Yes, it's the New York City area. And my location today is in front of a set of, upper, lower, middle beacon controllers. Since we're talking tower beacons, I thought I'd be at the base of a tower. Why not? Ever seen a skyline of those two beaches? That's where I'm at.
Wow. And, of course, while you were saying that, for the first time, all the tests worked out great, but the audio cut out during... Can you repeat the last couple sentences?
Sure. Tower beacon controls are behind me for a tower above my head. Well, about one flight above my head. And if you ever see the Manhattan skyline, Manhattan, New York City, look for the letters H&M, and that's where I'm located. Those are the type beacons that are flashing as we speak.
Wow. Is it now, do those flash 24/7 or just dusk to dawn?
These are 24/7 strobes, daylight, red at night, white light.
Ah, okay. White day and red night. There's a lot of that, a whole lot of that, the strobe activity going on to replace older lighting systems. And we're going to talk about tower lighting systems. That's the subject of our show today. And we have a specific subtopic, and that is the longevity of these LED bulbs. And the broadcast industry was pretty early to start adopting LED bulbs, and we'll talk about that. Let's go ahead and bring our guest in. Our guest wrote a couple articles for the Broadcaster's Desktop Reference, the BDR. And let's bring him in. Rodney Ziegler. Rodney, hello. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
Rodney, tell us a little bit about what you do as a director of engineering there in Nebraska.
I am the director of engineering for Nebraska Rural Radio Association. We have 9 stations from both the east coast of Nebraska to the west coast of Nebraska. We are located I am located in Lexington, which is middle south part of Nebraska, right along I-80. If you haven't flown over it, you've probably driven by it. And we have AM, FM combos everywhere. We have a big network that we use internet to get agricultural information out to other stations that we don't own as well. So that is our bailiwick, is agriculture.
Okay, so you put out a lot of ag information for farmers, farm managers, and people who work the earth to make a living, whether it's plants or animals, right?
That is correct, and that's who owns this. 4,500 farmers and ranchers in Nebraska came together after a huge blizzard that could not get the information for, and lost a lot of cattle and a few people, and created the Nebraska Rural Radio Association so they could get this information when they needed it. Bad weather, we're wall to wall.
Wait, now you said something that I just had not heard before. Most of the radio stations I've been involved with over my career, and it was small and medium broadcasters, are
have been privately owned, just one or two or five owners. And then some are public companies, right? So you may have worked for a public company, but you work for a radio station group that's owned by a co-op and you have 4,500 owners. What are those annual meetings like?
They're very interesting, actually. They tell us if we're doing something they don't like, and we listen and we fix it. But we also throw a big meal, and so usually you get chicken and noodles or roast pork or something for lunch, and then they elect a board of directors to oversee what we do and keep us on the straight and narrow.
Wow. Wow. So the topic, I want to talk a bit more about that later in the show. Our topic for the show, though, is LED lighting. And before we jump into that subject, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our first sponsor. And our show, This Week in Radio Tech, episode 293 with Rodney Ziegler. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Axia and the Axia X Node, the whole line of X Nodes. These are amazing devices. They look rather diminutive. Look, an X-Node is that little box right there. It is half a rack space wide. So you can put two of them side by side in a rack. They just bolt right together. Or when you buy an X-Node, it comes with the rack ears to, you know, offset it to the left or to the right and fit it in a rack. Now, what does the X-Node do? It does amazing things converting regular audio, the audio we deal with day in, day out, analog, stereo, balanced audio, or AES audio, or even mic-level audio. By the way, there's even an SDI X-Node if you're dealing with video with embedded audio. There's one of those, too. And the X-Node takes that audio in and converts it into live wire packets. But not just live wire packets. If your standard in your plant is something else, like Ravenna, you can convert it to Ravenna AOIP packets, or you can convert it to AES-67 packets. So you can run your AOIP network with the AES-67 standard. You can also do one more thing, and that's make an RTP stream, which doesn't require both ends of that to have their clock synchronized, because the stream helps to synchronize the clocks. And that's what Radio Sweden did when they broadcast from Sochi, Russia. They used an X node in Sochi and another X node back in Sweden and transmitted beautiful, perfect, bit-perfect, high-fidelity, non-compressed audio between Sochi and Radio Sweden across a fiber network that runs across Europe. Point here is that, you know, in the long run, except for maybe wireless applications, someday audio codecs will probably go away as our available bandwidth gets higher and higher. And you can start using in more applications, you can use a device like the X-Node. First of all, it's less expensive than a codec, and it's also, especially on a per-channel basis, it's way less expensive than an audio codec, and you get perfect audio quality across it. Now, you got to have the bandwidth to support it, and whether you're using LiveWire live streams, LiveWire standard streams, Ravenna AES-67, or RTP streams, the X-Node, the Axia X-Node, will just give you this incredible quality across, you know, fiber or any link that can handle it. Speaking of links, you may have been following me on Facebook, and you know that last weekend I installed an Air Fiber 5. It's a 5 gigahertz IP radio system in Mississippi, between a cluster of studios in Greenville, Mississippi, and a transmitter site 13 miles away that is going to have eventually 4 FM transmitters there. And so we installed the Air Fiber 5, put an X node at each end of that, and bam, we've got an STL with 4 stereo bidirectional links. And the X nodes were, about the least expensive part of the whole thing. The X nodes were, I guess, about $1,600 a piece. The radios, the pair of radios, was a little over $2,000. And so, I mean, look, for under $5,000 total, we ended up with an STL system, 13 miles long, stereo, linear, not compressed, and bidirectional. Plus, there's leftover bandwidth for things like video security cameras, offsite backup, just getting internet and VoIP telephone out to the transmitter site. So it's amazing. And it's the X-Node that helps make all that possible. Something else I want to tell you about the X-Node, they can be dual powered. They only have one power supply in them. So you can plug that into 110 or 220 volts or auto ranging. But the X node also can be powered by PoE, power over Ethernet. And it's standard PoE, so you can plug your Ethernet cable into your Axia switch or another Cisco switch, for example, and turn on the PoE, and you're powering the X node that way. So you're looking for dual power? You got it in the Axia X node. Absolutely an amazing device, especially for the money. My goodness. It's so quality built. And if you're using the mic version of it with the mic inputs, oh my goodness, the mic pre's are just so quiet and so perfect. Let me encourage you to check it out. I could go on and on, but I know we got a show to do. The Axia X node is really it's just like a Swiss Army knife of stuff you can do between networking AOIP and the real world of, you know, the in and out world of analog AES or mic audio. The Axia X node at axiaaudio.com or go to telosalliance.com. You can check it out and read all about it right there. I find a lot of uses for them. All right, we're talking with Chris Tobin. He is at a big, tall building in downtown Manhattan with a tower lighting controller. And Rodney Ziegler is also with us, too. Just in case Chris should happen to have to vamoose or anything, Chris, if you're available, do you want to spend a minute and tell us about the equipment that's behind you? And then we're going to get into the LED lighting subject. Now we may have to give Chris a little time. Is connect Chris? Sounds like your connection is not great. Oh, there we go.
Well, that's interesting. All right, seems like when we go to a split screen, it goes bad. Let's see. At the lower beacon on the east side of the tower is one controller box. Lower beacon on the west side of the tower is another controller box. And then there's the top beacon. Top beacon is one we're all familiar with. The top of a tower building structure. The electronics inside the cabinet. I cannot open the cabinets for obvious reasons. And it is working, because if you listen carefully, I'll do this.
Ooh, yeah.
And if I can do this right, which I probably won't be able to, but we'll give it a try.
By the way, that noise, Chris, that's the capacitor charge and discharge cycle, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So if we take a look at the camera, I'm going to move this. Go like that. Oh, look at that. That's what you'd see at the top of the tower.
Okay.
Can you see the beacon?
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us, and it's got a red section and a white section. What does what? Okay, strobe light in the red section.
That's right. And so that's what you have, the red section for night, white section for day, and this particular one. This was in service. If you look carefully at the bottom, you see the there's the seal tight and what's left of the electrical wire that was plugged into.
Yeah. Cool. So, does that one have a separate strobe?
Previously, service. There's a strobe. I can't get to it that easily, but yes, I can see it.
Okay.
Back into the camera. Yeah. There we go. Oh, my connection. I have a good connection, but who knows? So that's what you have. So, what's on the top of the tower is what I just showed you, and behind me are the electronics that turn on and off the lights that people are familiar with for flashing beacons on a tower as they drive through the countryside.
So let me see if I can set the stage here a little bit as we transition over to Rodney. You know, for years, of course, broadcasters have used towers for AM service, for FM service, TV, and, there's beacon lights on the top of buildings, too, to keep airplanes from running into them. And that's the whole purpose here, is to keep, aircraft from running into these tall vertical structures that are in the sky that would otherwise be unobstructed. So you got to warn airplanes about them. Keep them away. And for years and years, we tended to have red lighting and red and white painted towers, actually aviation orange and red and white, I should say. And, the way that a tower was lighted and painted was specified in the instrument of authorization, that is the station license. And there would be verbiage in there. It would either be right there or it might reference items that are in an FAA circular that would tell you exactly how that particular structure was to be lighted. And there's really, even though there are standards for this, there are a variety of ways the towers end up getting lighted. For example, I live a few miles away from the famous tower of WSM radio, the AM station, 650 kilohertz in Nashville, Tennessee, and it has a pretty interesting lighting authorization. The tower itself doesn't have any flashing beacons on it. What it has are just red obstruction lights, and on the roof of the transmitter building, there's a rotating beacon. similar to what an airport has, except instead of green and white, like most airports, it has a rotating red beacon. And it says that in the station license. In fact, the beacon was out of service for quite a while, and the engineer, Jason Cooper, there got it fixed and rebuilt and re-engineered, and it's back in service now. So, you know, this huge, tall tower, 750, 800-foot tower, has obstruction lights and a red rotating beacon. Now, most towers, though, aren't like that. They're lighted with a pretty similarly with various levels of flashing beacon lights, which are very bright, and then alternate levels of obstruction lights, which are a bit dimmer, and they don't flash typically. So that kind of sets the stage. Now, as technology moved forward, broadcasters noticed that, hey, red incandescent lights are life limited. You know, they do burn out. And they suck down a lot of electricity. If you've got a bunch of beacon levels, each level drawing close to 1,300 watts of power every time they come on, you can end up with several $100 a month power bill just for the lights. And so people started looking for less expensive alternatives, maybe more expensive to install, but if you only have to change them out every 5 or 10 years, which was the hope, and they used a lot less electricity, well, let's look at that. And that was LED technology. So that brings us to talking to Rodney Ziegler. Rodney, how did you come to start putting LEDs in at your towers, and when did all that begin?
It all began when I started here at KRVN in April of 2007. They had just built a 950-foot tower in cooperation with BOT Radio, and they had specified LED lighting for the three beacon levels and the clearance lights. I got here, the old director of engineering retired, and they said, well, we've had problems with these, and you need to fix it. Okay. The biggest problem seemed to be with those cold. If it got below 30 degrees, they quit flashing.
Huh.
And in Nebraska, it does tend to get below 30 degrees on occasion. So I contact the vendor. Vendor sends us another beacon to replace one that was out at the moment. We put it on. Same story. I get with him and say, hey, these aren't working. We've got to do something. He sends me a complete set of LED beacons on Memorial Day of that year, I think it was. And he even paid to have them replaced, all five beacons. We have a single at the top and two levels of double beacons. And those worked well for about 6 months. And then at the end of 6 months, the middle set of double beacons were intermittent. Sometimes they come on, sometimes they wouldn't. Temperature did not seem to be an issue. And so they were right in the aperture of one of the three FM stations there. They're right in the aperture of the antenna. So for one night, just as a test, I just flipped the transmitter off and up came the beacon.
So oh,
now
no.
We know we have. Oh, yeah.
RF.
So now we know we have RF issues.
Yeah.
A lot of back and forth. He told me, put another ground wire on all the beacons. So we pay to have a ground wire run from the bottom to the top, 950 feet. It didn't fix it. The next day, he said, well, cut it and see what happens. So I did. And then it kind of got loose, so we had to have it removed. Well, each of these, the installation and the removal were $5,000 just for the tower crew.
Oh, my
So
goodness.
Here we are, $10,000 down and nowhere. I looked at putting incandescent lighting for the beacons. LEDs, by their nature, take smaller wire, smaller conduit, etc. We would have had to put new conduit on, bigger wiring, a different controller. plus the beacons themselves and getting it installed. And that was close to $50,000 to do that, which we really didn't want to do. I went to the engineering community and put out an SOS. Anybody got any idea about something that'll work in a high RF situation? A fellow named Chuck Lucatus from Alaska got a hold of me, put me in contact with a company that sold RF suppressed beacons. And I called them. I thought, what the heck? What's phone call cost? Gave them a call. They told me they had such an animal. I told them my entire story. And they said, we're going to send you two beacons. You put them up and see how they work. Oh, okay. Hey. So they sent the beacons. We paid to get them put up there. Long story short, they're still there. And this is over 5 years later, going awful close to six, right in the aperture of that antenna. Spoke with the engineers from the second beacon company out at NAB 1 year and told them my story of woe. And the guy said, well, that's RF, getting into the power supply. I said, yeah. He says, we never even thought of designing anything to take care of that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. And the vendor was somewhat embarrassed because he kept trying to tell them and me that, no, it needs grounded. And it wasn't. It was RF getting into the solid state power supply.
Yeah.
So that one's been up there for 6 years, or those two have been up there for 6 years. In the meantime, our top beacon went out. It's close to RF with the top antenna, but not right in it. So we replaced it with one of these. It lasted about 2 years, as I remember. And then it went intermittent on us, which I thought was strange. And we were putting LEDs like this on all of our towers. We were retrofitting everything we could as needed. So I just grabbed another beacon from one of the other projects and had it put on. When they brought it down, the whole bottom of the beacon where the power supply sits had been full of water. So it even tried to work full of water. And, yeah, I'm sold, okay?
how'd the water get in there? Was there a bullet hole?
It was a misinstallation by the tower crew that I had put up.
Ah, yeah.
But I sent the thing back to the vendor, and the only thing they replaced in it, as far as I know, is the little connector in the bottom where you hook the 110 up, because it was pretty wasted. Mm-hmm. But and now it's on top of another tower over here west of town, because we bought a little 1,000 watt daytimer, and we completely changed all of its bulbs out, or its lighting out, to LED. Thank heavens, because when they pulled the top beacon down, it was cracked in so many places they had to tape it together. But now it's sitting up there with its LED, and it's brighter than it ever has been, and uses a lot less electricity.
Now, I haven't had a chance to look inside of the beacon-sized assemblies. I guess one of my towers, I haven't seen it yet, but the tower crew suggested, hey, your obstruction lights need to be replaced. We can put LED bulbs in there. And to my knowledge, they're just LED bulbs. They're not, they're clear, they're bright, they're meant for obstruction lights, but it's not a whole new obstruction fixture, I don't think. Have you heard of that kind of replacement, just an Edison bulb replacement?
I've heard of them, but I haven't seen them.
Yeah.
The ones we've done, all the clearance lights on KRVN's four tower array have been done. And that took an actual top half of the fixture. Like where you lift off the little red globe, this goes in its stead, and wires come out, and you hook those up to where the socket wires would be, so that we don't have any sockets to mess with.
I've got I'll try to put it on camera right here. I've got here at Broadcaster General Store. I was here doing some work with Telos, and I said, "Do you guys got any beacon, any LED lights around?" And sure enough, they have this obstruction light. Now, this is purpose built to be an obstruction light. This wouldn't be just a simple. It's different up here than a regular incandescent bulb obstruction light would be. And I wish I could open it up, but I'm afraid I don't have. Wrench handy to open it up, but I can turn it on if anybody wants to. This is really bright. There we go. Ooh, look at that. Oh my goodness. So that would be an obstruction light, and that is that's pretty stout right there.
Oh yeah.
This one is a Dialyte brand.
Mm-hmm. That particular model right there is what we have on our 950 foot tower. Since then, they've come out and they're smaller.
Ah, they're, okay. All right.
Yeah. Matter of fact, we had one of those go out.
I'm a little curious about the technology inside the beacon replacements. Now, on the beacon size ones, they remove the old, the whole 300 millimeter code beacon assembly, right? I mean, you can't just put an LED light in one of those, right?
I've never heard of that happening. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the really cool thing is these new ones are very short. You don't have to light the ground and you don't have to light all the sky. All you want to light is right where the tower is.
Yeah.
So that's where they focus the light. And these new beacon assemblies are much shorter and much harder to hit with a rifle.
Yes. Well, there was in one of your articles at the BDR.net, there was a comparison of beacon LED beacon fixtures from 2000 to 2010. And I posted that in our Facebook and Twitter feeds just as a promo for this show. And they showed them getting, starting out tall, almost like a 300 millimeter code beacon, and getting shorter until we get down to 2010. And it's almost like a little UFO, right? It's kind of flat. Flatten around, and the light just goes out from the edge. That also reduces the light to the ground, so it doesn't bother nearby residents as much if there's people bothered by that. I like red light for coming from a tower. I think it's cool, but not everybody does.
Sure. No. Matter of fact, if you're not used to them, they'll fool you. You'll go up to them and think they're dim. But they aren't. You've got to get away from them a few miles, and then all of a sudden, they're brighter than the incandescents. And it's plus. I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself. You also have to change out your equipment that monitors your tower lights, because the power usage is much less.
I do want to talk about that. I'm glad you mentioned that. We'll save that for after our next break. But I want to know about how you monitor these tower lights, and I'm really curious about that. I want to ask you, and also ask Chris. I got a feeling that Chris has probably seen more of these. I've also got this fixture, this dual fixture, and in all my years of engineering and looking at tower lights, and this is labeled with the words obstruction light, FAA type L8L. Well, it looks like LA10, 120 volts. Where is a dual light like this used? I would imagine in areas where you don't want to have to access it very often. So the original light, had places for two incandescent bulbs. One of them burns out. So what? You wait until, maybe they both burn out before you replace them. Chris, you know anything about this kind of fixture? I see Chris.
Radiation activity, like the glide path of a.
Chris, I'm sorry. It's just too bad. We're not getting
near
good audio. From
places that aviation takes place.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Sorry. It's
well,
it's
don't
bad.
Do the dual
it's
screen.
Bad.
Well, that's interesting. Wait, is it coming back?
I hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have no indicators here that there's a problem. But anyway, I've seen those structures, those particular light obstruction lights, on buildings that are near aviation pathways, like a heliport, airports, things of that sort. I don't know if that's an official thing,
But that's where I've seen them, the double light. Apartment buildings over in Queens at near LaGuardia Airport, I've noticed them. And the same is true in parts of Queens and Brooklyn where JFK. So best I can offer.
I think I've seen the same kind of, I've never seen these on radio towers, but on buildings near airports. Rodney, can you tell me anything about this kind of fixture?
I believe that's absolutely correct. That's where I've seen them, is in proximity to airports, military installations, things like that.
Well, this is a brand new one.
Seen them on tower.
And this is brand new, and it's LED. And by the way, I promise you, turn these on and they're bright. You know how much power this assembly draws? Seven whole watts.
Wow.
7 watts. Now, I need to look at this other fixture that we turned it on a few minutes ago, and let's see what it draws. It doesn't say on it. At least I don't. Nah, I don't see it on this one how much it draws. Huh. FAA type L810. Okay. All right. So, Rodney, when in the first part of the show, when Chris showed us that dual beacon that has a red section and a white section,
right?
Though Chris, it's a strobe light. Now, did you go through the strobe light era with your stations, or did you guys move from incandescents directly to LEDs?
We went from incandescents directly to LEDs.
Okay. Okay.
Saw too many of the problems guys were having with strobes and decided, what the heck? Let's just go this way and see what we can come up with.
Now, the LEDs, they in no way, there's no way that doing LED lights can prevent you from having to keep the tower painted. In other words, they're just a replacement for the red lights, right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
So some people either retrofit with strobes, or they put strobes on the tower from the get-go in order to not have to keep the tower painted aviation orange and white. They can leave the tower, you know, steel, nickel colored, you know, galvanized, and not have to paint it.
There are LED strobes too.
Really?
Yes. White LEDs, and they just flash them like strobes. And you don't have all the high voltage and all that to deal with.
Ah, yes. Okay. That's pretty interesting. I'm going to have to look into that for our tower, our towers. You know, maybe we can reduce our painting requirements if we would retrofit with strobes. But and myself, I've worked on plenty of towers that had the high voltage strobe lights, and you know, there's a lot of electronics involved with those, both on the ground and in many cases up in the air as well. And oh my goodness, you know, something goes wrong and you could have several trips from the tower company, even tower crews that know what they're doing, or they're from the strobe lighting company itself. I mean, I've had really qualified people go up there, but man, you got to go deal with a strobe 1200 feet up on a tower with no elevator. And you're talking about a big bill just to find out what's wrong, maybe or maybe not get it fixed.
That's absolutely right, and that's what we had run into with these LEDs that we were fighting earlier. Just troubleshooting was, you know, getting ridiculous, the cost of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, after the break here, we're going to talk about monitoring these lights and what you are seeing now is what you expect as far as longevity going forward with LED lights. And if you see any, you know, even different tech on the horizon, or is LED going to be it for the next, you know, 50 or 100 years or so? Also, I'm also curious as to if LED lights could be made to be solar powered, or if that's just more expense than it's worth, and, you know, the wind loading of solar panels. I just don't know. So we'll talk about some alternative technologies, you know, to the way we're doing LED lights now. Hey, our show is This Week in Radio Tech. You're watching or listening to episode number 293. I'm Kirk Harnack along with you. Chris Tobin is on the top of a skyscraper in downtown Manhattan. He's got some intermittent connectivity with us, but he did get to show us some tower lighting controllers. Oh, hey, how you doing? You back?
I'm back. I can hear you all very well. I just don't see you, but I'm doing well.
Okay. Chris, you want to add, before we go to break, anything you want to add to the discussion we've been having so far? Any comments about this?
No. You've touched on all the topics or any questions I would have had. No, it's definitely right on spot.
Well, I was curious about, you know, in Manhattan there, do a number of the buildings there, have they moved to LED lighting?
There's a lot of buildings with LED. You can see it. There's still folks with incandescent, and some of the beacons are still strobe. It's slow going because in some places the building code requires you to file for changes that you make, even though it's still a light. It's the type of light that you change.
Real.
So no one's quick to change things out unless it really dies.
Wow. There's rocks. Just a different LED system. I guess so. I guess that's a yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. Hey, our show's This Week in Radio Tech. 293 is the episode talking about LED lighting, and we'll get through it. We'll absolutely get through it. Chris comes to us from some tough locations sometimes. Rodney Ziegler is our guest from Nebraska. We're going to be right back in just a minute. Our show is brought to you by the folks at Omnia, and we haven't talked about the Omnia 9 in a while. I got to tell you, this is an FM audio processor, but it's more than that. It with the right options, the Omnia 9 can process your FM radio station. It can also process one or even two HD stations at the same time. And it can process audio for your web stream. If you want to do proper web stream processing, you can do that as well. The Omnia 9 is the brainchild, of several people, but mainly of Leif Claesson. Now, if you're familiar at all with the Breakaway processor, then you know that Leif Claesson has been building incredible processors and processing software, multi-band stuff, for years and years. And the guy is an absolute genius at doing this. And Leif has this way of listening to what engineers want and incorporating that into the audio processor. And Leif also gathers technologies from other people. So Leif has had a engineering relationship with Hans von Zutphen and put in some of Hans's technology into the Omnia 9 as well. That would be the Declipper technology and Leif's own Undo technology. So what's the Omnia 9 do? You know, when you bring audio into the Omnia 9 processor, first of all, if you've got music that is hyper-compressed and even clipped, the Omnia 9 has this Undo technology to decompress it, and also the Declipper technology to actually restore peaks that have been cut off, usually in the mastering process. So Hans's technology to rebuild peaks that it doesn't know exactly what was there, but it looks at the audio before and after and makes a lot of really intelligent assumptions and can rebuild this audio. The effect is when you listen to a song that you're so used to hearing on the radio as being clipped, or even right on the CD, it's clipped. A lot of metal songs, for example, some hard rock, and even some modern songs are clipped. The Omnia 9 just really reverses that and breathes some real life and brings some fun, at least for my ears, brings some fun back into that audio. Then once the audio is clean, Leif Claesson's processor does a lot of amazing things. It's got a multi-stage AGC, including a sideband EQ, which you can really tailor to make the AGC work just like you want it to. You can also then it sends it to the multi-band AGC and multi-band limiters, and then Leif's really intelligent FM clipping section. And then, after that, if that's not enough, Leif has this stereo embedder. It's a little bit different than a stereo generator. It uses this technology that is just amazing, where you end up getting on the air, on your FM station, you end up getting about 1 dB or even a little more loudness out of the demodulated audio for no more modulation on your mod monitor. It is just amazing to see your mod monitor peaking at 100% and seeing your left and right audio peaking upwards of 125, 130, even 140%. There's mod monitors out there that won't even properly register the demodulated left and right audio after it's gone through Leif's stereo embedder. Just amazing technology. There's multiband look-ahead limiting available in it, so you can properly process for your HD radio, which uses a psychoacoustic codec on your FM. Also, you can it's the right processing also for streaming. So if you want to do streaming and your Omnia 9 is convenient for you to do that, you can absolutely do that too. It has a beautiful 7-inch front panel touchscreen, full remote control, and I should mention Leif's remote control for his processors is a program. It's a Windows program.
And the benefit here is really high speed. You get beautiful high-speed real-time displays of what's going on with the audio, including real-time analysis, RTA. You get FFT displays. You also get this time graph of loudness over time, and that is really helpful to see how your input levels are being handled and how it's affecting your output levels or not affecting your output levels. Just amazing stuff. You got to check it out. You can you might be able to get a demo from your favorite Omnia dealer. Of course, you can order one, put it on the air, and I just promise you are going to love it. I see the Omnia 9 processors in so many stations, especially big city stations and medium markets. If you want to really improve your station, you need to check out the Omnia 9 processor. Go to omniaaudio.com or go to telosalliance.com, leads you to the same place, and look at the Omnia processors and look at the Omnia 9. Dual power supplies are standard with the Omnia 9, and that beautiful touchscreen is there as well. Lots of inputs and outputs, and hey, I'm telling you, it's really amazing. Omnia 9, thank you, Omnia, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Okay, Rodney Ziegler is with us. Chris Tobin is with us. He's at the undisclosed downtown transmitter site in Manhattan, or tower site, I should say. I'm not sure if there's transmitters there or not, but there's certainly beacons that are keeping the building safe from helicopters and airplanes. All right, Rodney, tell me about LED lights. Hey, for years I've used these little panels from Sign Systems. You put a toroid that the AC power goes through, and it integrates the measurement of current over a long time and gives you a sample voltage, and that becomes your aha. If it's that voltage, then that means that my tower lights are all good. But with LED lights drawing, you know, 4, 5, 8 watts a piece, a bit more than that for a beacon, how do you monitor that remote?
How we do it is when we buy systems, the lighting systems to change out from incandescent, we also buy the controls for it. Within those controls are some very small little modules. Let me see here if I can, that are maybe about like that.
Okay.
That have both an on and an alarm on it. So if it's on, it sits there. If it's a beacon, it flashes. If it's your side lights, it's steady. But if something's wrong, the alarm comes on, and they're each calibrated for however many beacons or however many side lights you have. So they're wonderful. Just put a whole new control system on our little 1 kilowatt here west of town and bypassed everything on the tower. It had the flasher, everything up on the tower about 10, 12 feet off the ground, including a fuse that somebody put in there one time or another. I was sure glad to go buy that and put all the controls in the building. But it has two of those little flasher monitor modules in there and outputs that we can wire up to our remote control. And you can test them easily, and they work just wonderfully for us. Just real happy with them.
So you just tie that alarm into your remote control, and if it's good, there's no alarm, and if it's bad, you get an alarm, right?
Yes, and it stays alarmed until you fix it. So if something went wrong during the night, you come in the morning and there's an alarm light on your remote, you've got a problem you need to handle.
Hey, tell me about, you know, I'm used to photocells, and in most, you know, smaller towers, like 300-foot towers, all of the lighting current also goes through the photocell. What is the case with LED lighting systems? Do you get a new or different photocell, or do you end up using the same one that you may already have mounted on the tower or under the eaves of the roof of the building?
You can use the same one. In the instance of our tower over here west of town, we chose to go away from the Fisher Pierce old cadmium sulfide photocell and get a more modern photocell that is mounted up by the building. You know, each are FAA certified, which is the important part, but that's kind of what we're doing too, is as we go along, all four of our towers out at KRVN had the old Fisher Pierce look like an electric meter, cadmium sulfide cell. And we're not having real great luck with replacements. Matter of fact, we've had to kind of come up with our own little modification to make those actually work. But that's we're going to the newer cells as we do put these in. We had a tower, FM tower, on the east coast of Nebraska that had incandescent lighting on it. It's only 5 years old, and we had nothing but problems up there. We went ahead and changed it out to LED because we were paying so much to have people climb that tower to change light bulbs. have not had anything, have not had a problem since we changed out to LED, and we just used the same photo cell and all that there because it was of the newer design.
Gotcha. Hey, now, thinking about these beacon assemblies with LEDs, so they have a number of LEDs, either some of them look like they're back inside or behind a curved reflective thing that, you know, helps guide the light, you know, out in a fairly narrow beam. So what do you do? Can you replace just a section of that, or do you have to replace all the LEDs at the same time? What's maintenance like if something goes out?
I don't know. I've never been to that position.
Well, that's good. All right. I got the impression we had a tower lighting guy, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember what company he was from, but he pointed out that you know, there's, I don't know, about 12 or 16 sections around there, and they were individually replaceable. You know, one screwdriver, and out it comes, and you can pop a new one in. So I just wondered how that
never
would work.
Been to that yet.
So I'm still curious about the LED elements themselves, the actual things that have two terminals on them and give off all that light. What voltage are they running at? Do you know?
I have never put a voltmeter on them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's got to be a smaller DC because there is a pretty good power supply in the base of those.
Yeah,
and it wouldn't surprise me what it may not be 12 volts or something like that. I don't know. Never measured it.
Have you ever had lightning blow up the plastic or acrylic cover on these things? And I ask because I've had several strobe lights that I think the acrylic was weakened by sunlight and weather over time, and then either hail hit it or maybe a lightning strike blows a hole in the acrylic or plastic. I'm sorry, I don't know what material that it is. And, you know, it ends up ruining the strobe assembly. You end up replacing the whole strobe assembly. Have you seen that happen?
I've not seen one of mine be destroyed, but I have, like the one we took off that had water in it, had obvious signs it'd been hit by lightning. But it never put a hole through the acrylic.
Huh.
You could definitely see the little pinpoints of the lightning. In different places, they're really bulletproof. They really are. That's what I like about them.
Thinking about the you mentioned the LED strobe assemblies, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I had never heard of that. So that's pretty cool. Do LED strobe assemblies, do they have like a day mode and a night mode?
As I've heard, they do.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, it's just, you know, how much voltage you hit the LED with, I guess. But,
I remember being a contract engineer, and I'm sorry, I was stepping over. You go ahead.
No, that's okay. It's the LED technology allows you to do so much. It's basically the limits of your imagination.
So I remember in the 90s, especially driving around, maybe in the early 2000s, a lot of strobe lit towers in West Tennessee, North Mississippi, East Arkansas. And I tell you what, it seemed like every other strobe lit tower I would see had the same failure. The strobes would fail in day mode at night. Now, I guess that's probably better than night mode during the day. But as a pilot, now I didn't fly low to the ground. I had no reason to do that except near an airport. But as a pilot, I tell you what, man, day strobes at night will just freaking blind you. It's terrible.
I can believe that. But, I can. I've seen that too. a tower north of Wichita, Kansas. I used to engineer in Kansas, and that's where I'm from. Was notorious for being day mode at night, and you could see that thing for miles. It was just, yeah, it bothered people on the ground too. So,
sure.
Yeah.
And I don't know if tower operators, I actually heard one engineer and tower owner say something to the effect of, well, you know, it's okay for it to be daytime lights at night because then it's extra bright and nobody's going to hit it. No, actually, it's not okay. It's first of all, that's not part of your authorization. But second of all, if you stand on the ground and look at a tower at night, and let's say it's a dark night and the tower itself is not lit up. In other words, the structure's not lit up. So you really can't see the tower. You can only see where it is by the fact that there's strobe lights on it. Well, daytime strobes flash once. You know, it's one super bright flash. Nighttime strobes, the typical behavior is it'll flicker. It'll go like, you know, it'll flicker several times on, and so it has the effect with the persistence of your eye of being on for a half second or three-fourths of a second or maybe a full second. Point is, if you got a tower at night and the strobes are running in day mode, your eye really can't lock on to where that tower is. The muscles in your eye keep moving past it because it's not on long enough to go find it. And one night I saw a tower flashing out in a rural area, and it looked like a UFO. It looked like a light that was moving around over the cornfields. And so I even stopped the car, got out, and stood there and looked at it, and it was a dark night, and there were no other lights around. The structural members of the tower were not otherwise illuminated in any way, so your eye could not perceive what was holding the light up in the sky, right? I mean, I knew it was a tower, but it was day mode strobes, and no matter how hard I tried, my eye could not lock onto it, and it just looked like the thing was moving around the sky, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I stopped at another tower that was properly working, you know, night. That's when I learned about day mode, night mode, and what the difference was. And with the night mode being on longer, flickering on, your eye had time to go, oh, lock onto it. Now, of course, during the day, this is not a problem because you can see the structure. So, you know, your brain knows what's holding the light up in the air. It's the tower structure. You can see it.
Sure. Yeah. I had something similar happen to me last Saturday night driving back up here from visiting the kids in Kansas. Strobe light over to the right side of the highway, and I thought at one time there were actually two towers there.
Ah.
I thought, why'd they put two towers that close together? But they did. It was just a single strobe, and it was just exactly that. My eye could not lock on it. So... yeah, this is and it's the thing that is fun is you can drive around now and you can tell incandescence from LEDs just from miles away, and not because of the brightness or anything like that. Incandescence slowly extinguish.
Sure.
LEDs immediately extinguish. And so that's how you can tell who's changed and who hasn't.
Yeah. They the incandescent ramp up, ramp down, and the LEDs are on off with a very sharp edge. And of course, strobes at night properly working, they flicker. Now LEDs flicker too, but I believe they flicker a little faster. You know, like at either line rate or half line rate. And so if you scan your eye across the tower real fast, if you see a bunch of up in your vision, then you know that's not an incandescent light, because an incandescent light won't do that in your eye. It'll be continuously on. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, I want to check in with Chris. If Chris is available. Okay, Chris.
I'm here.
We got color bars. Hey, Chris. Talk to us about day and night strobes. Do you have this problem in the New York City area, or is this simply a rural flyover state problem?
No. There have been issues with the strobes here in the city. I worked for a radio station some years ago where we had our strobes go to the night. Day strobes went on at night, and we had to quickly take care of that, because it turns out
that two of the towers were faced, the strobes were facing in such a way that they lit up the entire neighborhood.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where we had to take care of it as quickly as we could. It was disturbing, but it was interesting. But I know there have been a few times here in the city where there have been issues with obstruction or beacons, but there's a lot of backups in place, and you never know that there's a bit of a problem.
I have things.
I have noticed that a subject common in the cellular industry is placing the top beacon such that its downward light is minimized very much. But you also have to watch out that you're not setting the beacon too far down, or putting antennas up around it in such a way that you are limiting the horizontal exit of the light from the area, and that apparently has been a problem. Sometimes they'll put some new antennas up that are taller or different, or they'll clomb some more antennas on there, and they're in the way of the light. Rodney, have you ever seen that or known that to be a problem in your part of the world?
I've heard of it, but I've never had to experience it personally, thankfully.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and in broadcast, we typically don't have that problem. You know, I remember back before the time that you had to have, like, let's say you had to have, now you have to have two beacons if the tower structure's in the way. I've even seen some towers with three beacons on a level so that from any angle of approach, here's what I went and read the rules. I read the FAA circulars rules about lighting placement. Of course, on the top of the tower, generally one beacon is fine because it stands way up in the clear and there's nothing obstructing its view. But at other levels on the tower, let's say you have a tower that is the height that you have a mid-level beacon. It used to be that you could have just one beacon sitting out on a platform next to the tower. But the fear was, well, hey, I can't see that beacon from certain angles because the tower's in the way, or some coaxes running up the tower are in the way. And so I read the rules, and the rules said, I being a pilot too, the rules said that you must be able to see the beacon from any normal angle of approach. To which I had to ask myself, well, from what angle would I normally approach a tower? And the answer is, I wouldn't. I would not normally approach a tower.
That is
true.
Yes.
Chris, it sounds like you're back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you could also have a tower like I did in the glide path of an airport. So all the lighting you did had to be on all three points of the tower structure. We had two beacons at the top. We had obstruction lighting on two levels that went around the tower, so it was three lights per level. And, yeah, it was fun. Yeah, we every angle of approach. And then we found out there was a heliport nearby for the local police department that nobody knew about. So that's one of the reasons why our authorization said you have had all these lights. And we're like, oh, that explains a few things. So, yeah, you got to treat the tower lighting. I've always said to folks, treat it as though you're a pilot. Look up the information what the pilot's relying on and see if you're come close to meeting the rules, both FCC and FAA. Because this is amazing. Like the cellular towers, I've driven past some that I've at night, and I'm driving down a long road. It's very dark, but you see this little red beacon. But it doesn't look right. You know, as Rodney pointed out, it's like, yeah, you can tell the difference. It's like, something's about it. Sure enough, I've passed many a cell tower where the beacon is obstructed by new antennas or sector antennas that are being put up around it, and nobody's paying attention to the fact that, yeah. I mean, I remember that years ago there was a ruling, not ruling, a lot of times if you put up a tower, if you say a monopole, you had a monopole antenna set up, and the FCC would say, you know, you have to be so many inches or feet above the top bay on the pole, even though the pole may be 200 feet or 210 feet. You still had to have something at the top. Nowadays, it's like, you know, it's like the Wild West when it comes to cellular stuff on some occasions.
You know, come to think of that, I have seen some towers where the top of the tower ended and the antennas essentially ended there, but then there was another extension, a pole, and then the beacon's base was attached to a flat attachment to the top of that pole. So the beacon was really well up into the clear. So, yeah, wow. I'm amazed, Rodney and Chris, at this bulb right here. It's not a beacon. This is an obstruction light, so it stays on all the time. There, I can see three. There are three beacon bulbs right in there, And I don't know what the I can't get into it. So I can't tell exactly what the interior looks like, but it does put out such a narrow, pretty narrow band of light, because it just has to, illuminate or be seen by aircraft that are approaching the tower from the side. So nobody's approaching it from the bottom, and nobody should be approaching it from the top, although it does have some lights there that you can see when you look down on it. But the bulk of the light you can see on my face. It's not shining up here. It's just shining right here. So fun with lights, fun with tower. I've got a 300-millimeter code beacon in my office. I keep threatening to fix it up so I can, turn it on at a reasonable light level. Right now it's got 620-watt bulbs in it. But I need to put something in it that's a little bit less obtrusive. I got to turn that off. That's really bothering me. Hey, we're going to take a quick break and be back. I'm sorry, Chris, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, you're talking about the beacon in your office. So you can recreate the scene from Seinfeld where Kramer and the lights, and they can't sleep at night because of the red light from the fast food restaurant across the street. Just a little movie reference for fun. Just a little humor.
I haven't seen that episode. I've seen the soup Nazi episode over and over again, but I need to see that the Kramer episode with the light. Hey,
it's a
Rodney,
reference for a beacon.
Rodney, usually at the end of the show, we try to supply a tip to our viewers and listeners, something that maybe you think is kind of cool that that you'd like to pass along to other engineers. So during our next commercial break, if you could be thinking of something that, a tip I'd always like to pass along to my friends, then I'll call on you to do that. All right.
Sure.
All right. Our show is brought to you this week in Radio Tech with Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and Rodney Ziegler. It's brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo, LAWO. They make audio consoles, and they make a line of smaller consoles for broadcasters, for radio stations, podcasters, and that's called the Crystal line of consoles. But they make a version of the Crystal console that has a multi-touch touchscreen monitor. You actually touch a touchscreen to move the faders up and down, to make selections, turn faders on and off, to change options, to change the back feed, to do all the things that you would normally do with a physical console. There's a picture of it there we saw on the website, Lavo, LAWO.com, and it's the crystal clear console. Now, like any console, sure, it's got mic inputs, it's got line level inputs and outputs, and it's got some AES inputs and outputs, but it also has a network connection on it as well. This network connection is for two purposes. Number one, this is where you connect it to the network, and elsewhere on the network, in the same room or in a different room, you attach the multi-touch touchscreen monitor and its computer, which are actually one unit. So you put it on the network, and you're controlling it over the network, which, by the way, means that, today I want to do my show from a different room. You can do that. Unplug the thing, go elsewhere on your network, plug it in, and have control over the mixing engine and all of its functions. But the other reason that it has a network connection is for audio over IP. Yes, the Crystal Clear console has the Ravenna standard built in, and it's AES-67 compatible. So that means that you can send AOIP to speakers or other brands of equipment that will accept AES-67, and you can also receive AES-67 signals. Hey, there's even a Neumann microphone now that puts out AES-67 and other devices as well from other companies that do audio over IP. So this makes the Crystal Clear console really convenient to set up in an environment that is not going to go out of style or become out of date from a technology point of view. Now, because the console is basically software defined, that means that there's some cool things you can do. You're not limited by hardware circuits. You're not limited by buttons that are limited in their function because, they're physical buttons. You can do all kinds of functions with contextual buttons that when you push it, it just brings up the menu items that have to do with that fader right now. If it's a mic fader, you can punch a button and bring up an automatic mic leveling routine, for example. So you can set the mic preamp level automatically. You can set the back feed volume and source, for example. Of course, it's got the usual stuff. It's got a preview function, so you can preview any fader coming in. It's got a built-in clock, beautiful clock, slave to an NTP time server, so it's always accurate to within a millionth of a second. All these features are standard with the the Crystal Clear console from Lavvo. You can also get dual power supplies in the Crystal Clear as well. So if you have two sources of AC power, hey, you can really take advantage of that as well. I want you to check it out on the website. There's a video on the product page where Mike Dosh, who's the director of virtual radio projects for Lavvo, where he's describing all the features and benefits of this console. And it's pretty interesting. It's about a 10-minute video or so. So you want to take a few minutes and check that out. The whole notion of running an audio console on a touchscreen is pretty intriguing. And, of course, with software upgrades, you can change the functions that it will do. If you think of an improvement that needs to be done, well, that can be done in software. So check it out, Lavvo.com, L-A-W-O. Look under radio products, because they do make a line of television and other things too, and look for the Crystal Clear console. Thank you very much to Lavvo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, let's see if we can bring Rodney in real quick. Rodney, you got some sage advice or a tip you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I do. If you decide to go with LED lighting, and you put an LED top beacon on a tower, make sure that you have static dissipation equipment up there of some kind that is just within the light beam. The reason being, if you're out there at night and you're looking at the top of a 950-foot tower, you're not going to see the top beacon. You can't tell whether it's on or off. But if you have
nothing reflecting its light, is there?
Right. So if you have your static dissipation up there, all of a sudden, like we have four red flowers that light up every time it comes on, and we know it's working.
Because you could see the light reflecting off those static dissipation flowers, but if they weren't there, unless you've got a foggy night, there's nothing to reflect the light. It's a beam going out, but you can't see it.
That's exactly right. Or have a friend 10 miles away looking at your tower for you.
Yeah, give you a phone call. Or, hey, how about this? Those static dissipation arrays are pretty helpful. I really like those. But it could be a good excuse to buy a drone, because you could send the drone up there and check on the line.
There we go. As long as I don't countermand any FAA regulations doing it.
Oh, that's right. There's a 400-foot limit on the drones, and your tower's 900 feet tall.
There you go.
Well, that's a good idea, though. Put something that's doing a job and a little bit reflective, but doesn't really, get in the way of the light that an aircraft needs to see. And should be good. Cool. Good idea. I will remember that. All right. Let's check in with Chris Tobin. Chris, are you with us from Manhattan?
I'm here. Yes, okay. I'm here. And that tip about the beacon and putting something in front of it, I've driven past tower sites that people have done exactly that. It's pretty cool. Yeah. So you can see them lighting up their static cats. Yeah. It's absolutely cool.
Yeah.
Hey, the tip, I received a couple of emails regarding SpinRite when we talked about it, I think, last episode or the episode before that. It's grc.com is the website. I don't know if we've mentioned it or not, but I got a couple of emails asking where to find it. So that's what you do.
Yeah.
SpinRite version 6.0 is grc.com. And the other tip is, recently this week I was working with a friend. He relocated his offices, and we built a new lab for him, a radio lab. It's an RF engineering firm. And we discovered that if we didn't use shielded twisted pair Cat 6 cable in the office area, two-way radios and certain cell phones were getting picked up on the lines. We're not sure why it was happening on standard Cat 5, Cat 6 cable, but it was happening. So I would suggest, if you're working in a place where you know there's going to be RF of any kind happening, consider shielded twisted pair. It's worth the expense, because we discovered a few things that were just not right. It was just an office/lab area.
And how did you end up, did you use shielded RJ45 connectors on the ends?
Yeah, we went full shield all the way through, just to, because it's an RF site. I mean, it's RF lab. You do a lot of work, but people walking around, it's an industrial park, and we discovered that part of it was, the two-way radios for the maintenance guys and other things. And we're trying to figure out why the computers were having issues, and we're seeing different types of errors in the packets on the switches, and like, nothing going on in the office, but yet we're seeing trouble. And one of the guys out in the office goes, there's a guy out here talking on a radio. They're doing some cellular work. Do you think? And sure enough, we break out the spectrum analyzer. We start looking along the spectrum and going, oh. And that was it. As odd as it may seem.
At least it wasn't, you know, Elmer in the next cubicle powering up his kilowatt ham radio, or at least it wasn't the guy down the hall with his kilowatt CB linear.
Well, yeah, that's always a possibility nowadays. Yeah. Pirates.
Yeah, all right. Hey, Chris, thanks so much, and appreciate you checking in and going to the trouble to show us that lighting equipment way up there. I know where you are. I think I've been at least in a room close to where you are. Yeah.
No, yeah. You've been up here. Yeah, it's a transmitter site. There's transmitters here of all types.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for that, and thanks for your tip. And Rodney, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate you being here as well. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And let me thank Omnia. We just opened a brand new 9 yesterday, and I just ordered a 1 this afternoon. So thank you, Omnia, for sponsoring this.
Hey, you should have done the Omnia 9 commercial.
There you go.
Well, thanks very much for all that support. Really appreciate it. And hey, viewers and listeners, if you would support our sponsors, yes, 2 of them are my employer, Telos Omnia, Axia. We alternate the ads quite a bit. Appreciate that very much. And do check out our sponsors. Also want to thank Broadcasters General Store. They provided my conference room today to do the show in, and the bandwidth for me to connect to you today. I'm down here at Broadcast General Store doing some training with the good people here. So thanks very much to them. We really appreciate their help and making us feel very much at home, including providing some lighting right here. Yeah. All right. Next week, we've got a great show coming up for you. And in a couple weeks, Rich Redmond from Gates Air is going to be with us. You know, I'm very curious about what's been going on at Gates Air. They do keep coming out with, you know, they have good transmitter designs and some codecs and such. So we'll be talking to Rich Redmond coming up in the next couple weeks about that. So that's it for our show. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.